This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
The night sky for February 2020. Well, as darkness falls, the lovely region of the heavens, including the constellations of Orion the Hunter, Taurus the Bull, and Gemini the Heavenly Twins, is beginning to move over towards the southwest. In Taurus, we have the lovely pair of open clusters, the Hyades and the Pleiades. But in fact, the brightest star that you see towards the Hyades is Aldebaran, which is only about halfway between us men. It's a red giant star. Orion is a wonderful constellation, and I've actually put a picture of it up on the Night Sky page this month. Just search for Night Sky Jodrell. And it shows, in fact, five nebulae, as well as the stars we all know. And the exciting thing, perhaps, is that whereas in that image, which I took actually probably in late November, Betelgeuse is obviously much brighter than Bellatrix, which is the top right-hand star of Orion, it's now almost equally the same brightness. So it's dimmed by getting on for a magnitude, which is quite amazing. No one knows if that's perhaps the start of it beginning to become a supernova. We shall have to wait and find out. Down to the lower left of Orion, you just take the three stars of Orion's belt, follow downwards, you come to the brightest star in the northern hemisphere, called Sirius, in Canis Major. Up to the left of that is Procyon, one of only really two obvious stars in Canis Minor. And above them, of course, we've got Castor and Pollux in Gemini. As the evening moves on towards midnight, so Cancer, a very, very faint constellation with a lovely little open cluster called the Beehive Cluster, or Prisipe, that moves over, and that is between Gemini and Leo, which you'll see with its brightest star, Regulus. So quite a lot to look for, and I hope you enjoy observing these wonderful winter constellations for the next month. Well, what about the planets? Jupiter. Well, as February begins, it rises more than 90 minutes before the Sun, shining at a magnitude of minus 1.9. During the month, it brightens to magnitude minus 2, whilst its angular size increases slightly from 32.5 to 34.1 arc seconds. You'll need a low southeastern horizon to spot it, and sadly, due to the amount of the atmosphere through which we're looking, our views of the giant planet and its Galilean moons will be somewhat hindered. Well, Saturn. Well, Saturn passed directly behind the Sun on the 13th of January, and as February begins, will rise less than 1 hour before the Sun. Then, equipped with binoculars and a very low southeastern horizon, it might be glimpsed at magnitude plus 0.58 in the pre-dawn sky. But please, of course, do not use binoculars after the Sun has risen. As the month progresses, its magnitude actually reduces very slightly to plus 0.66, as its angular size increases from 15.1 to 15.5 arc seconds. Now Saturn crosses the ecliptic, which is the path of the Sun across the heavens, in the southerly direction on the 13th. That's just 13 days before Jupiter reaches that point, and at the same time, on the 1st of February, a bit later, Mars, in fact, is rising across the ecliptic. As we'll see later, there's a lovely alignment of them along the ecliptic later this month. Mercury passed in front of the Sun, that's called superior conjunction, on the 10th of January, and during February comes to its greatest elongation east, some 18.2 degrees in angle from the Sun. It starts the month at magnitude minus 1 and dims to magnitude plus 0.2 by the 14th, and will then soon be lost in the Sun's glare. From the 1st to the 14th, its angular size increases from 5.6 to 8.1 arc seconds. But at the same time, its phase, which is the percentage of its disk that's illuminated, falls from 85% to just 32%. That obviously gives rise to the fall in magnitude. On the first of the month, it will set about 70 minutes after the Sun, and will have an elevation low in the west-southwest of about 9 degrees. This will increase until the 10th, before it begins to fall back towards the Sun. Binoculars may well be needed to spot it, but again, please don't use them until the Sun has set. Well, Mars can be seen towards the southeast in the pre-dawn sky at the start of the month. It then rises some 3 hours before the Sun and will be seen best at about 7 a.m. at an elevation of 8 degrees. It will have a magnitude of plus 1.4 and a 4.3 arc-second salmon pink disk. By month's end, it will be seen further round towards the south before dawn, and its magnitude will increase slightly to plus 1.1. Its angular size will have increased to 5.5 arc-seconds. But unless you've got access to the Hubble Space Telescope, you won't see any markings on the surface. It lies along the ecliptic, moving eastwards above the teapot of Sagittarius, and will lie just above the lid on the 24th. Finally, Venus. Well, Venus is now dominating the southwestern twilight sky and appears higher each night, climbing from about 29 degrees above the horizon at the start of the month to more than 38 degrees by its end. Its angular size increases from 15.3 to 18.6 arc-seconds, but at the same time its phase decreases from 73% to 62%, and so the brightness only increases very slightly from minus 4.1 to minus 4.3 magnitudes. Well, what about the highlights? Well, it's still a good month to find M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, and perhaps around New Moon, M33 in Triangulum. And on the Night Sky page, just search Night Sky Jodrell, there are two ways of finding it shown on a chart. On the 3rd of February, the moon lies between the Hyades and the Pleiades cluster. So it's a waxing moon moving towards full, lying somewhat over to the right of the Hyades cluster. After sunset, on the 7th of February, Venus lies almost directly above Mercury. So low in the southwest, Venus will not be missed, it's so bright. But to spot Mercury, which lies down to its lower right, a low horizon just south of west, and perhaps binoculars will be needed. But again, please don't use them until the sun has set. If you're up about 7 a.m. on the morning of the 18th of February, you might be able to spot, if it's clear, a very thin crescent moon lying just to the right of Mars. That could be a very nice photo opportunity. I'll hope it's clear. On the 27th of February, after sunset, a very thin crescent moon lies down to the lower left of Venus. You'll need a low horizon towards the west. And if you're lucky, and it's clear, you should spot a very thin crescent moon lying down, as I said, to its lower left. On the 29th of February, before dawn, there's a lineup of Saturn, Jupiter and Mars along the ecliptic, around 6:30 a.m., be about the best time to look for it. Again, you'll need a low horizon towards the southeast if you're going to actually see Saturn, which will only lie a little way above the horizon. I usually include something to observe on the moon, and this month, on the 1st of February and the 14th of February, the Hyginus Rill is near the terminator, so making it easier to see. For some time, a debate raged as whether craters on the moon were caused by impacts or volcanic activity. We now know that virtually all were caused by impact. But it's thought the Hyginus crater that lies at the center of the Hyginus Rill may well be volcanic in origin. It's an 11-kilometer wide rimless pit, in contrast to impact craters which have raised rings. And its close association with the rill of the same name associates it with internal lunar events. It can be quite easily seen as it's surrounded by dark material. It's thought that an explosive release of dust and gas created a vacant space below so that the overlying surface collapsed into it, forming this rather unique crater. Well, we've still got some quite long nights. I hope we get some clear nights as well. Good hunting.
Thanks for that, Ian. And for our Southern Hemisphere listeners, here's Haritina Mogosanu and Samuel Leski with Night Sky Where You Are.
Star Safari.
Star Safari. Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Welcome to a new decade of astronomy, discovery and fun. I'm Haritina Mogosanu.
And I'm Samuel Leski.
and together we are Milky Way Kiwis. We have today a very special guest.
My name is Peter Detterline. I'm from the United States, and I love looking at the southern sky. So if you want to find out what's happening in the southern sky, this is the podcast to check.
Thank you, Peter.
And we can confirm that for those who believe in the flat earth, that Peter did not fall off the earth in coming to New Zealand.
But he came here on an airplane.
That's right.
We've been looking at the night sky over the last 2 days, and we did catch a little bit of a glimpse of the night sky. So what do you think of the southern night sky, Peter?
I love the southern night sky. And I know coming from the north, the thing we always want to talk about are the Magellanic clouds, because they're so different and so neat, and we don't have anything like them in the north. And then when you get down here, you forget about them because you're just blown away by the Milky Way. And that is just spectacular. Now, at this time of year, the center of the Milky Way, of course, being directly overhead, is just mind-blowing, but that's not at this time of year. But I will say, after looking and examining the entire Milky Way, I still think my favorite part has to be from Alpha Centauri out to Eta Carinae, including Crux. It is spectacular.
There's so much stuff in that area.
It rivals our Cygnus in the north, that part of the arm, and it is just amazing. And this is a good year and a good time of year to go out and start to see that.
Star Safari.
Oh yeah, well, February, it's starting to get quite nice and high in the sky. At a reasonable time too, so you don't have to stay up till 11 o'clock when it's properly dark. In February, the sun sort of goes down like 8:30, obviously later towards the end of the month, which means by sort of 9:30 you can get a pretty good dark sky, and you can take in all those wonderful sights between the Southern Cross, False Cross, Diamond Cross, all that area there. It's really, really amazing.
Of course, now in the Southern Hemisphere is summertime, so we have the shortest nights, and we've been suffering from it because it got dark almost at 9 o'clock in January.
Yeah, it got dark just about time to get up in the morning again.
So we really had like maybe just 3 hours of observing.
Yeah.
Really good dark sky observing.
Yeah.
3 hours.
Well worth it.
You should come back in July.
That's the best time to see that Milky Way high overhead.
That's right, yeah.
But there's lots to see in February and other times of the year down here too.
Well, of course, in February we get into the sensationalist season of really big full moons. So, and you know how every year they come up with quite amazing names for full moons, like Blue Blood Wolf Moon or whatever. I've decided this year for the February full moon, I think we should really go out on a limb and we should call it the February full moon.
That Ooh. Is amazing. That is very astronomical of you.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that one.
No, well, what do you reckon it'll catch on?
We have the micro moons and super moons. Our February full moon.
Yeah.
That might catch on.
That's a great idea.
I reckon we could give it a go. I mean, I'm putting it out there to see what people reckon.
So we're looking forward to hearing your comments on Facebook.
Yeah. Do you think the February full moon should be called the February full moon?
What else is in the sky?
Well, to be fair, actually, the February full moon is at about 360,000 kilometres, so it is a little bit closer than normal, but not as close as it is the following month, where it's at about 354,000 kilometres. So it is that time of year when the full moon looks a little bit brighter than normal. So we start getting into that. From a planet point of view, not a whole lot's going on in February, unless you're willing to stay up really late or get up really early in the morning. And then you'll see Saturn, Jupiter and Mars from about 4 o'clock. There'll be a reasonable height to have a look at, especially towards the end of the month. And earlier in the month, of course, you can observe Mars. And we all miss Mars because we haven't seen Mars for a long time.
Yeah, we miss Mars a lot.
And there's an opposition of Mars coming up this year, which will be...
But we're still graced with Venus in the evening sky.
Oh, true, but we see that all the time. Actually, one that always seems to get forgotten is Mercury. So maybe in February we'll try and see Mercury. I don't know when we'll see Mercury in February.
That would be fantastic. Always enjoy looking at Mercury. Yeah. Nothing like seeing the smallest planet.
Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things in the sky right now, and this is for the northern hemisphere or the southern, and one of the beautiful things about astronomy is it changes. Mm. And one of the beautiful things about astronomy is it doesn't change. You can always go out and see the same constellations, but nothing ever really stays the same. And there's nothing better than that than Orion the Hunter right now.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Now, in the northern hemisphere, Orion glides across the sky with his feet to the horizon. And here he's got his head pointed down and kind of staring at the ground as he moves. But that star that marks his foot is the bright star Rigel. Beautiful blue star, which means foot. And when you get to Betelgeuse, the star that marks his shoulder, meaning the armpit of the giant, beautiful red star out there, they kind of rival each other in brightness. Rigel's usually a little bit brighter. But this January has been absolutely amazing in that Betelgeuse has gotten fainter. Nothing odd about that, except it's gotten really faint. Much, much fainter than has been really expected. And right now we're wondering, how faint can it really go? So if you want to have some fun with Orion, take a look at Betelgeuse and Rigel, the two bright stars, one marking his arm, one marking his foot, and compare them up and see how faint Betelgeuse really is. Look at Betelgeuse compared to the belt stars of Orion. Is it going to be fainter than the belt stars? Look at the other star that marks Orion's foot, Seif, and see if it's fainter than that. Because right now it's getting very, very close to that. And that is really phenomenal. We don't see Betelgeuse this faint. So in February, the big question is, will it continue to get fainter or will it start to get brighter again? And that'll be a really cool thing to check. So that's something you can do on the next clear night.
So Peter, with Orion's shoulder, Betelgeuse, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And potentially Orion losing his shoulder. So being this big chap with a big sword who's pointing at the ground, will we have to think about a different story for Orion?
Well, it's going to be tough. If he loses that shoulder, I mean, he's holding a club with that shoulder, so the club's got to fall somewhere, right?
Mm. Well, that could be a problem. I mean, I don't know who's going to be the problem.
And for you guys, it's facing the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's falling directly.
Now, in the northern hemisphere, we just hit him in the head.
Well, of course, Betelgeuse, being Betelgeuse, used to be Alpha Orionis.
Back in the 1600s, when they first looked at this and put this on, that was the brightest one in the constellation.
So that's why it's still noted as Alpha Orionis, though is not the brightest star in Orion anymore.
I have seen it much brighter than Rigel in my life. Big, and it just kind of expands and gets bright, and then it contracts and gets fainter, and it does it very irregularly. It's a star that's dying. It's like someone taking a labored breath, and you're not quite sure when this is going to happen. But there have been nights I've seen it much brighter than Rigel, and then it would zip back to its normal brightness and a little bit fainter. But this time it's a lot fainter, and I've never seen Betelgeuse this faint, and that's kind of exciting.
Of course, and if you go on the internet now, or you go on Facebook, you are flooded with memes of Betelgeuse is dimming, meaning it's imminently about to explode. But of course, that doesn't actually mean it's going to explode.
It could, if you're into the exciting part of that.
Yeah.
Betelgeuse will become a supernova someday. It will explode. Some say it's already exploded. We're just waiting to see that light come to us. However, from a really rational scientific point of view, probably not. This is probably not some preemptive thing that's going to blow up next Tuesday at about 2. Now, stars like Betelgeuse often throw out a lot of dust and gas.
Yeah.
And it, for lack of a better term, might have just burped up some stuff and is hiding behind a little shell of some gas at this point.
A bit of carbon hanging around in the outer atmosphere.
Which could be cool because maybe it'll just stay kind of dim for years.
Yeah.
Of course, here in New Zealand, we don't have Orions. We don't even have Scorpions. But we have a lot of gastronomy, and Orion in New Zealand is called the Pot. And the Pot is made by the three stars of the belt as the bottom of the pot. And also by the Sword of Orion, which here is the handle of the pot. And you can totally see a pot.
In fact, you could almost say that Betelgeuse is like the fire underneath the pot. And it's like someone's just dialed down the thermostat a bit.
We could do that, yeah, yeah.
You've taken the most recognizable constellation in the history of astronomy and turned it into a pot.
Well, that's New Zealand.
Who doesn't use a pot?
Welcome to New Zealand.
And, you know, I can see the handle. All right.
Yeah. Well, it's a little saucepan. Yeah. Maybe the design isn't great. But it actually looks like a pot.
It does, actually.
I mean, it totally doesn't look like a dude with a club.
I'm going to have a lot of trouble explaining that back north because your pot's filling everything all over the place. But
the Milky Way. That could be the story of the formation of the Milky Way.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Of course, getting into February, we're probably going to start losing our wonderful couple of months where we've had to look at Pleiades, which is for us in this part of the world, rose in June when we celebrated Matariki. And over the last few months, of course, it's been visible earlier in the night until now, where it's quite wonderful and quite high in the evening sky. But of course, in February, it's starting to duck a bit close to the horizon. So we're going to start losing the sight of Pleiades as it gets into that unfavourable position where we won't see it again until about June. So while you can see it in February, get out there and have a look.
Yeah, back north. Wow, we see the Pleiades until about May when the sun enters into the constellation they set into the sunset. Yeah, that's interesting because it's just going to dip down below your horizon before that.
Just not in there.
It's not too high in the sky.
Right. Yeah.
Never really gets that high. So it's probably the best time is about, well, now really, isn't it?
February, yeah. March, maybe stretched.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Deep Sky Adventures.
In the universe.
Deep Sky.
Deep Sky Adventures.
Star Safari.
Just because I really don't like the moon, like I do not like the moon. I cannot say how many times I've said I don't like the moon because it casts too much light and you can't see.
But are you going to light the February full moon?
Oh, I'm going to say when the full moon is going to be in February, so don't go outside and observe. It's going to be on the 9th of February at 8:32 p.m.
Well, it's going to mess up, you know.
The worst time to look at the moon is when it's full, first of all. It's just way too bright.
It's almost like the worst time to look at anything.
At anything, yeah. We just do other stuff. Yeah. Dance or whatever. The best day in February to look at the stars, so plan your stellar activities around that, is on Monday, February the 24th, when there is the new moon. Kind of like first week of the month will be full moon, and last week of the month you will have new moon, so then it's a good time to go and look.
And actually the full moon makes, well, it's an amazing amount of difference the moment it appears above the horizon. If you remember last month we were having a good observing session, we were looking at a bunch of stuff
and we're happy, right?
We could actually see, you know, sculpted galaxy and some of the galaxies in the sculpted group pretty easily.
Beautiful area.
You could see the brightness of the moon on the horizon had risen at that point, and it was
like light pollution from a neighboring city.
But it's amazing because as soon as it appeared above the horizon, gone. You couldn't see these faint galaxies. You still see sculpture a little bit because it's such a bright galaxy, but the other ones are just gone and no hope in seeing them. So it's almost like someone turns off all the galaxies as soon as the moon appears.
So everybody be aware of the February full moon. Samuel called it.
Yep.
February full moon is going to happen on Sunday, February the 9th.
Mark your calendars.
Or not. Do not come out of the hut.
Go and harvest your beetroot or whatever you do. February with a full moon.
February full moon, not just for werewolves anymore.
Star Safari.
Here is summertime, so we are in the last month of summer in February, so it would be the equivalent of August in the Northern Hemisphere, right?
Right.
What would you normally do in August?
Perseid meteor shower.
Oh, we don't have one.
The dog days of summer.
The dog days are gone. Yeah. Not in here.
We'll make the most of the last opportunity to go swimming, maybe. So anyway, the other cool thing that's happening in February, as we sort of mentioned before, is the Milky Way is getting higher and higher and higher. So that really neat part of the sky between the Southern Cross and Orion is in obviously a more favourable position to look at things, which is awesome because there's lots and lots of things to look at that part of the sky.
The beautiful part about being down here now is seeing the Magellanic Clouds. Mm-hmm. And the large Magellanic Cloud is coming up close to the meridian. The small one is heading over into the west a bit. But as we get into February, that small Magellanic Cloud is going to be getting a little bit lower, a little tougher to see. Mm-hmm. But the large Magellanic the cloud and the tarantula nebula, all that beautiful stuff will still be up nice and high, and some of the best times to take a look at it if you're not out on the February full moon.
And well, actually, if you have an O3 filter...
Yep, you can see so much of the terrain.
So now you want them to go out on February 9th to look at the Large Magellanic Cloud.
Yeah, well, here's the challenge.
Right. Yeah, get out there in that February full moon, that, you know, ancient February full moon.
And if we could make sunglasses with O3 filters on them.
That'd be amazing.
You know, if actually a couple of weeks ago we held up a 1.25-inch O3 filter to your eye like that, and you just scan the Milky Way, and Eta Carina Nebula was the brightest thing in it. So normally you look up there and you can see, you know, Alpha Centauri is really bright. But actually, with poking your eye through the O3 filter, it was Eta Carina was the brightest thing. It's quite cool. So yes, you probably could make glasses with O3 filters. But, I mean, we're a rather expensive pair of glasses.
We should talk about this. This could be a really good product invention for you guys.
Right.
Patent pending.
Yeah, right. Nobody listening to this.
Patent pending.
Nobody.
It's already in. Patent's already in.
You haven't heard anything.
It's for copyright.
Peter is our Milky Way correspondent from the Northern Hemisphere. He talked to us many times about events that happened there, like the eclipse, the solar eclipse. Now we have you here. Tell us how that eclipse was.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the eclipse was absolutely fantastic. It was the sixth total eclipse I've seen. I've traveled around the world to see these things. But this was the very first one I could actually take a telescope to. We could pile as much astronomical stuff in a Jeep that it could hold. There was barely room for passengers.
Oh, who needs passengers?
Yeah, who needs passengers? Well, I'll tell you what, it was...
one.
Imagine going to see a total eclipse and you can bring anything you want. That was the most fantastic part of all. And I decided to set up with two telescopes that were identical on the same mount side by side. One had a camera and I could visually look through the other one. And that was just, honestly, I didn't even really take a look at the pictures. I'm just kind of, here, okay. And just kind of moving things back and forth. But I got some good images as well. And it's always fun with friends. And I watched it out west, in the American West, and as it got dark, and you hear people screaming and shouting from all the hills and countryside around, and getting all excited, the sky turned really, really dark, and we heard wolves howling, which was really kind of neat.
It wasn't people pretending to be wolves.
You know what, maybe.
It wasn't a wolf moon.
But it wasn't a full moon.
Right, not a wolf full moon.
It would have been a new moon, so...
I do have the t-shirt, I still have it.
Oh, good.
I'm bragging with it everywhere.
Good. What amazes me with the people that image the eclipses is how they can come up with some really fantastic images. But it's not something you get to practice that often. That's what, you know, with me, it takes me a lot of practice to get a decent image. So I don't know how good I'd be at taking an image of that.
You have an eclipse that lasts 2 minutes. That 2 minutes goes by really, really fast.
You've got to have your setting. You can't stuff it up and go, oh, geez, I'll try this setting next time.
And a lot of people, I would prefer to take an eclipse on land because I know the land's not going to move, but I've been on a lot of eclipses at sea where you're on a cruise ship, and they practice the day before, and they stop the ship to show exactly how it's going to be, and you can look on your screen, and you watch the sun go up
to the top of the screen,
and then come down, and then go up, and when it goes up, you got a few seconds right there, so you put that in the center of your frame. And then when the ship goes up, you know, like click, 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 and it starts to go down. And it starts to go click, 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 and you start moving. It's really wild, so you don't get any shakes to the thing. But yeah, there are all sorts of ways to work that, and you hope for the best.
Yeah.
But I will say with each eclipse, it's kind of like a faster version of Halley's Comet. Every time Halley's Comet comes around every 76 years, we got better and better technology to view it, better telescopes, instruments. Our eclipses are like that now. Our cameras are better and more portable, and we're now stacking images and learning how to do that. And with the CCDs, the images are much better than with the photographic film we used back in 1991 when I first started, and cringe looking at some of those pictures, but remember fondly what it looked like to the eye.
Yeah,
so the next one will even be better.
We call them retro, we don't call them cringe-worthy.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to get in any image at all, but it's staggering to think the equipment people use. And I think you talk about Halley's Comet, and I remember the photographs of the Cook telescope. It's the Carter Observatory that took a picture of Halley's Comet back in 1910.
Right.
And it's a great picture for 1910. You think, wow, it's just incredible how far the technology's come. But the camera, of course, isn't a nice, cool little 1.25-inch high-speed camera that can do 150 frames per second or more. It's a big wooden box that you chuck a photographic plate in. You'd have to have a few of those and hope for the best.
And Halley's Comet in 1986 was fantastic for you guys in the Southern Hemisphere.
So we heard.
Well, I saw it. I saw it from a broken old binoculars.
Well, I'll tell you what, I saw the Northern Hemisphere and I knew what I was doing. I knew where I was looking. I was showing people, like, really? And there was nothing really. There was this faint, tiny little splash. Went down to Aruba off the coast of Venezuela and it was bright tail the whole bit just days later.
Well, I don't remember it being that big. I always remember back in when I saw it, it was kind of small and stunted little thing. But, of course, it depends when you look to it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, the next apparition, 2061.
I'm ready. You ready? You ready?
Yeah.
You guys are ready for
it? Yeah,
I'm hang around though. That may be a little
rangy,
but
you have to.
I've got all my equipment because I said I'm not going to afford any more until then.
And again, the best place to see it will be the Southern Hemisphere for that one.
Of course.
So you guys are in great shape for that. So put that in your calendar for 2061.
It is done.
A lot of great podcasts to listen to before then, so, keep up with it.
Prepare people to what to look for.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Speaking about the sun, nothing happens on the sun.
Well,
it's
actually,
one tiny little.
Well, it's been the sun, of course, has been very exciting this month. With was it AR2753, I think, the active region, which has now developed into a sunspot.
Yay!
Which is hugely exciting. Now, hopefully, in February there'll be some more exciting sunspots. But it's been, I think, the longest period without a sunspot for an enormous amount of years so far this year, which is. Well, I mean, the sun's really in its minimum. And I think it's at peak minimum in April this year. And then it'll, maybe it won't. Maybe it'll stay minimum for longer than we think.
For all of us who enjoy imaging with those solar telescopes we spend all that money on, we're really kind of waiting for solar max to come up in a few years.
Oh, yeah.
So
it'll be interesting to see how many solar maximums solar telescopes last for.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari. Star Safari.
So let's talk about the northern part of the sky and the things that are...
Gemini
will be in the sky in February.
Gemini can't be up very long for you guys.
No, those the two polyps and Castor, they stay pretty low.
But they're very beautiful and you can actually see them in the sky. They're distinct.
You can even see them in polluted Wellington light pollution.
I always look for them from Cat Observatory. It's one of my favorite things to look for. And I don't know why, but I've always looked for the Gemini.
Gemini is a beautiful constellation. And maybe it's because I'm a Gemini. I don't know, but I like it.
But are you a Gemini?
Yeah. Or was that just invented in the 1920s by a British newspaper? But it's a good story, right?
Right.
And actually, and I think an area of the sky which is actually quite fascinating, has a lot of stuff around it, is that area around Canis Major. And, from underneath Sirius there, there's some really cool little clusters and objects. You've got the big, more famous ones like M50, M47, 46, M93, all those open clusters. But there's some really cool other clusters. In fact, under Wezen, there is NGC 2362, which is an amazing little cluster that's got a really bright star in the middle of it, a really hot blue star. And that looks just amazing. Tiffy, have you seen that cluster?
That one I have, yes.
Yeah,
I have.
It's quite cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, not far from it is the cool little double 145 Canis Majoris.
That one I have to look for.
I think we call it the Winter Albireo. Albireo.
Albireo.
Yeah.
Okay, Albireo.
Albireo.
Everybody says Albireo.
Let's just all agree we'll just call it El Burrito.
El Burrito.
I'm going to call it 145 Canis Majoris because that's easier to say. So, of course, that's a lovely double, which has that really contrasting colour between the blue star and the yellow star. It's really amazing to look at. And that's
a good separation, obviously.
Yeah, they are. They're kind of close enough that they're clearly, in the same family. But far enough apart you can easily spot them, so you don't need perfect seeing. But they look wonderful, and it's nice and bright too, and relatively easy to find. But not seen by a lot of people, because it's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's going to be on my list when I get some clear skies. I'll definitely check that out. One of the things I always check out when I come down to the southern hemisphere is Alpha Centauri.
Oh yeah,
because we're talking, it's our closest star, and I want to see both of them. The main star is a carbon copy of the Sun. The other one, a bit oranger, is out about where Uranus would be in our solar system. But looking at it with binoculars, no, you're just seeing one star. You really need a telescope, and you're going to need some magnification in order to split them up a bit. And that's kind of a cool thing to be able to see that split. But they are tight. They are tight.
And especially at the moment, because I think it's about a 5 arc second split between them at the moment.
Yeah.
It might even be a tiny bit less. So they have a 70-year rotation around each other. So, of course, what we see here on Earth is that split getting wider and thinner.
Gotcha.
On a cycle, right. which is kind of cool. And, of course, when you see them, they always look like a pair of little yellow headlights on a car off in the distance, with one headlight being a bit dimmer than the other one.
That's interesting. So maybe when I saw it before, they might have been a little bit further apart. I don't know where they were in their orbit with that.
Yeah, I can't remember what their maximum split is or not, but I know at the moment...
But if they're far enough apart, are they... binocular? Can you split them with binocs?
No, I don't.
Not even when they're at their farthest?
No, I wouldn't. Yeah.
Unless you're looking at a super pair of binoculars.
Well, that's it. If you've got a couple of 8-inch reflectors.
Azira is my favourite star in the northern hemisphere, and I saw it once through a telescope I remember from somewhere in Transylvania, with a telescope I dragged there by myself. It was quite an experience in the middle of the mountains where the seeing was really, really good. And I still remember the blue and the orange hue that it had. It was just beautiful
colours, and it's nestled in the Milky Way. It's just gorgeous on a really
gorgeous
clear night without any moon. Boy, that's spectacular. Yeah. Let me ask you guys this. Of course, you've seen the double Alpha Centauri many times. And you've been able to split that
last
easily enough.
Yeah.
And I needed a Barlow last night with an 8-inch telescope in order to split it. But what I've never seen is Proxima Centauri.
No.
It's 11th magnitude.
So it should be easy to spot.
We wanted to look at it.
Well, maybe we need to find it.
That's the hard part. It's 11th magnitude, but we're talking a red dwarf star. It's closer than Alpha Centauri, but you can say, I just saw the closest star to the Sun.
We want to. It's on our bucket list.
But it's a matter of identifying it would be the hard part.
Well, maybe if you have a GOTO telescope, you can.
Yeah, but I'm still thinking the field of view is going to be filled with stars. You're going
to
have to try to pinpoint.
But Sam would be able to identify.
Well, 11 magnitude's not very...
How tough can it be? It's small, faint,
come
and
on, Sam, you can find anything.
I mean, basically, with that big telescope, you can see the birth of the universe, so we should be able to... We should be able to find it.
Here's the challenge. Let's identify Proxima next time.
Well, and if we get bored with that one, we can always go have a look at Acrux and split that. That's a bit closer than Alpha Centauri. So we want a bit more of a challenging one to push the good seeing.
I split the Alpha Centauri last night with a 16-inch telescope, and I don't know what eyepiece you had.
Oh, that was a huge eyepiece. I think it was 32 mil or something.
Yeah.
I needed the 22 with a 2 Barlow for the 8.
Yeah, you normally got to throw the double Barlow in it. Acrox is a bit harder. You've got to probably use a 9 mil eyepiece and the Barlow to split that one. But you can split it. I mean, you can still see it. You can drive a bus through the gap. So it's pretty...
No, this one was really close together, but it was still beautiful.
It's quite low.
It was pretty bad.
Of course, the trick with these is... Wait till they're out of the atmosphere a bit.
And you could spend a lot of time with the Southern Cross.
Well, if you can wait, because we had cloudy skies, an hour and a half into the sun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for February, it'll be up a little bit higher.
Yeah.
We'll get some clearer skies, right, if you're not out there during the February full moon.
Mm. Oh, yeah, that one.
And you have the jewel box and the cold sack and just really wonderful stuff.
We also looked at Omicron Velorum. That sounds like Chancellor Velorum. And that was very beautiful.
Tell me about that one, because that's one I'm not really familiar with, and you guys rave about that.
Well, I think it's really awesome. It's kind of in the same type of open cluster like Southern Pleiades. It's big. You've got to move the field of view around a little bit to see all of it. But it's just off the...
It's on the left-hand side of the False Cross, yeah.
And it's a nice big open cluster. There's not actually that many stars in it, but they're nice blue stars. They look really cool. And you can see it naked eye.
It's to the left of Delta Velorum, that Omicron Velorum cluster, and here it is.
But through your telescope you're talking, this is a really pretty section of the sky.
And then, of course, you have NGC 2516.
Or as it's known locally as the Sprinter, because it looks like a person sprinting. And in fact, it's got a it's got a gold-coloured star in it, which kind of almost looks like the Sprinter's wearing a bit of a medal. So they've done quite well.
Gold medal.
Mm. It's also known as the Southern Beehive, because it's also it looks like a swarm of bees buzzing around. The Southern Beehive is a really beautiful cluster. So there's a lot of stars in that, and there's some colour variation and magnitude variation. So it's quite cool. And whereas actually another really cool cluster, a little bit towards Eta Carinae, and here is this cluster here, Wishing Well Cluster, which is this. You put that in the eyepiece, and the whole eyepiece is just filled all of these stars, all of these bright stars that almost look about the same distance apart. The whole eyepiece is just like a big sea of stars. It's a really beautiful cluster.
That's a wonderful view through an eyepiece.
Like people throwing money in a
wishing well. You just picture all these big, you know, I guess they come from the US dollars, silver dollars, right, sitting in the bottom of a...
I think you guys need to put a little bucket there by the telescope. When they look at this, they can just...
Throw a 10-cent piece in there, please.
Hey, for February, let me ask you this. 47 Tucani is going to be a little bit lower.
Yeah.
But Omega Centauri is going to be a little bit higher.
Yeah, well, if you
A good time to compare the two of them?
It probably is, actually, because you probably want to start a bit later to get Omega Centauri up.
They're kind of at opposite ends.
Yeah, but you could compare the two.
But why should you compare them when 47 Tucana is the best? Like, we all know that, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Omega Centauri may have a black hole, which I think is pretty cool.
They're two very different types of globular clusters, which makes them really an interesting comparison.
One may have been a galaxy. Well, and it's so great that in our sky we've got these two really impressive globular clusters. Actually, it's interesting. So 47 Took is always overshadows its very close next-door neighbour, the small Magellanic Cloud, which in itself is a really impressive globular cluster, NGC 362. Which is actually quite big and quite bright as well. And you can resolve the stars, with a good eyepiece, you can resolve the stars to the centre. And I think it's a really impressive globular cluster. The problem is...
And overshadowed, of course, by 47 Tucani. Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of Gem Cluster near Eta Carinae, which is Gem Cluster's really beautiful, very tight little cluster of stars. And it's kind of, I think, more beautiful than Jewel Box. But, of course, nobody ever looks at it because it's got this big, giant behemoth next to it, Eta Carinae. And all the excitement that's happening there. So by the time people have looked at that, they go, oh, we're a bit bored of this area of space, now we'll go somewhere else. And they overlook poor little Gem Cluster, which is a really lovely little cluster.
Sounds like you guys need to have a globular cluster night
February.
Yeah, we should.
Well, actually, the best time for globular clusters is when Scorpius is really high, because you've got...
Then they got M80 and M4 and...
Not for a long time. We'll have to wait.
Your summer.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be winter then.
Well, you just have to come back then.
That's your winter or summer.
The truth is, I don't think I have seen anything more spectacular than the center of the galaxy right up above at zenith. It's something that we're not used to in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's daunting. It is wow.
Whereas in the Southern Hemisphere, it's like that again.
The first time I saw that was in Africa, and it was at the zenith, right at the zenith. And it was just mind-blowing just to see the arms extending out. And you could see the bulge of the galaxy and just Magellanic Clouds that way, Andromeda back the other way. And it's like, wow, what
you
a perspective.
See those dust lanes stand out something wicked, don't they?
Just amazing. Just amazing.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Right, where else is in the sky? So not too much action with the planets in the evening sky.
Well, what's interesting, earlier in the month, I think on about 3rd of February or around then sometime, Uranus is getting very up close and personal with the moon. But the moon will be about 50%, so it'll be a bit bright, so you won't spot it naked eye, obviously.
We did see Saturn a couple of months ago, didn't we?
Yeah, well, I did, in the occultation.
It was amazing.
Mm. Well, it's not doing one of those, it's just doing a flypast in the sky.
Oh, but because it's going to be so bright then. What about the morning sky? Is anybody here morning owl? The morning chicken.
Well, the morning sky.
Is it clear them up?
Morning rooster, one of those thing at 7 o'clock in the morning.
So we're talking about some planets in the morning,
well,
right?
Yeah, so the morning sky is going to be great to see our old friend Mars, that we haven't seen for quite some time, as it pops up.
And just starting to get Scorpius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that centre of the galaxy is starting to appear, you know, early in the morning. Getting
still kind of low, though.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's Saturn and Jupiter appearing on that side as well.
Like a string of pearls.
Some make a pre-lineup.
And over the month, Saturn and Jupiter change their position, and Mars just gets a bit higher. So get ready to see Mars in winter. And, of course, Mars has its opposition later in the year.
In October.
Mm.
Mm.
That'd be wonderful. Yeah, that'll move fast enough.
Yeah. Mm.
So talking about Mars, Peter, you are the chief astronomer of the Mars Desert Research Station Observatory.
Yes.
How does that go? What does it even mean?
Well, we've got a simulated Mars hab out in the Utah desert, and out there we've got all sorts of different activities for crew members to go out. It's a place where people go to learn how to live on Mars. And I've been out there and asked to build an observatory for them. We now have two of them. One is a solar observatory, and one, of course, takes a look at the nighttime sky, and it's robotic. So it's able to be used anywhere over the internet.
Wow.
So crew members can use it, and we have students using it, and that sort of thing. And it's a really phenomenal place under some very, very dark skies in the United States.
Which actually looks like what Mars looks like in pictures.
It does indeed. And you're well aware because you've been out there. And that's actually where we first met.
Guilty as charged. I thought it was the most amazing place I've ever been to.
It is a beautiful place,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, like people have withdrawal symptoms when they come from Antarctica. Everybody's like, I want to go back. And that's how I felt. And I will always feel about the MDRS. It's the place where I just felt like at home in the middle of the desert. And I cannot explain.
It's my home away from home, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just something about the site. And it's just beautiful.
And, you know, all those stars. And when I was there, I remember Andromeda. And I remember the double cluster from Perseus.
And Albireo.
Albireo, and wow.
I'm sorry, El Burrito.
El Burrito.
I'm going to make people hungry.
And the best thing ever in there, I remember I was once in the hub, and I'm looking towards Phobos Peak, right? So Phobos Peak is the top of this mountain. Mm-hmm. Like a tiny little hill a little bit further away from the hub. And I'm looking there, and there is this rock on top of it. And it's called Phobos Peak, and I'm looking, and I think it took me like a week into the mission to actually realize that the rock on top of the hub looks like Phobos, Mars's moon.
Mm.
Of course it does. Why else is it called Phobos Peak? But it's an amazing place. Why astronomy on Mars?
Well, I think astronomy is good on any planet, as far as that goes. It's something that we really want to take an interest in the sky. And Mars is a great place to do this. The nighttime sky is incredibly dark, and it's perfect for doing astronomy. We're a little closer to the asteroid belt, so checking on asteroids and their motions, making new discoveries there, would be really kind of cool. It would be really good for doing our basic research, which astronomers always love to do. But I think one of the big things would be working with parallax measurements with Earth.
Mm.
And parallax is a way for us to calculate distance. And what you want to do is you want to take a look at an object, let's say in December and in December and June of the year. And you take a look at the same star, and you're using the entire Earth's orbit as a baseline, and you can get this small angle. The angle, you can calculate the distance. If you have that angle, you can calculate the distance. And the farther away it is, the smaller the angle. So you want the baseline as big as you can possibly get. Well, the biggest baseline we can get is the orbit of the Earth, if the star is at a good spot for seeing it in both December and in June. On Mars, we could actually have a baseline that extends all the way out to Mars from the Earth, which would be phenomenal. and really give us a good heads up as far as distances out there.
And you could do it at the same time.
At the same time.
So you wouldn't have to wait 6 months.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, using two identical telescopes, go out there and get your information right away. So those would be some really important things to do. And of course, solar observatories for the sun and just kind of making sure that we're not frying our astronauts up there with solar radiation and all the harmful stuff that comes from the sun. We definitely want to know when solar flares and all those things happen, although right now I think they're pretty safe if they were up there. Doesn't seem to be a whole lot happening on the sun these days. But Mars is a phenomenal place and a really good place to do astronomy. You're not going to have any cloudy nights, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, at least you have one.
It will be a little cool, though.
We could have a dust storm the last time.
Yeah, the dust storm could be a problem. You're right.
So the thing about Mars is you can't actually put a telescope to your eye. You were saying about this last night.
Yeah, it's really difficult to look through a telescope on Mars because you don't want to take your helmet off. That's a really bad idea. So everything's going to have to be remote, which means you get to sit comfortably inside the hab with your cup of coffee or tea and right in the computer, just type things up and see your image come through. And that's the way it'll have to be done.
So, of course, what a lot of people don't realize, it's not the temperature and the lack of a breathable atmosphere that means it's bad to take your helmet off. It's the lack of pressure. Because of the atmosphere is like you said last night, it's at 100,000, basically what it'd be like on Earth at 100,000 feet. Which is incredibly high.
Yeah.
You know, that's three times higher than what the commercial airliners fly.
What's the highest you've been?
Well, the highest I've been is 46,000 feet. So that's not even halfway to how, and up at that height you
had. And you had to wear a suit.
Yeah, you've got a, it was in a small jet, so you had to be pressurized and on oxygen and stuff. And you know, as the, you know, you look at the SR-71, the U-2, when they're flying at 80,000 feet, 70,000 feet, they're basically in spacesuits. So when you're at 100,000 feet, which is even higher than that, it's basically no air. So the pressure, of course, means things are going to boil at a very low temperature,
right,
including your skin and blood and everything, and the inside of your eye.
Not nice.
Yeah. So that I imagine would be the first thing. If you decided to actually have a look at the telescope with your eye, you're probably not going to use your eye again.
What we need to do is develop an observatory, because we love to look through the telescope. That's the romantic part of it. That's the beauty of it. You know, in science, we don't do that too much anymore, but that's the really fun part about going out to the Star Watches, is looking and physically seeing this and getting your mind and heart filled with that.
Well, I'm sure you could build a little membrane
around that. Well, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. Can we build an observatory that has a type of pressurized membrane, but now you're looking through something else which is going to distort the image?
No, like the membrane sealing the...
So you have the telescope stick outside the dome like the old cartoons and have a little membrane in there?
Yeah, you just sort of move around.
Must be a way to do it.
It's really going to be an interesting membrane as you're moving the scope around and following and tracking. That's
there's some really smart people out there.
That would be...
Well, but until we go to Mars, let's encourage our audience to go out and look at the night sky as much as they can.
With your own eyes, because you're not going to be able to do it on Mars.
Or binoculars.
Right.
Or telescopes.
Or just your eyes.
Or just your eyes.
Just your eyes, But I mean, just seeing the Earth from Mars would be the most amazing thing.
Well, we're always watching Mars from Earth, right?
Imagine that.
imagine
spending all that time and effort like we do now trying to image Mars. When people are on Mars, they'll spend all that time and effort trying to image Earth.
Star Safari. Another amazing thing that you do, Peter, you draw pictures of the night sky, right? And these are deep sky objects that you're drawing.
I just started doing sketching. I've had the time now to do sketching, and I love it.
And you're very talented, I must say.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm still learning and still growing with this, but what I love about sketching the most is I'm looking through the telescope. And I do everything with the scopes, and I image, and I do all this stuff constantly, but sometimes I image so much, I'm like, I really just want to look through the telescope again. I need to get back to that. And sketching really allows you to notice where the stars are located, and really allows you to take the entire scene in. And you look at it first, and you think, what looks unusual about this? What's the thing I want to capture with this? And your eye has to really soak it in and take it in, and you start to see the little nuances and different shadings and things, and it's fun. It's really well worth it. You get to know the object when you sketch it.
Very, very well. Well, I did sketch the, what's that galaxy?
Oh, Sculptor Galaxy.
I did sketch Sculptor Galaxy a month ago.
Mm.
And I did it because I wanted to put it in my brain and remember where it was so when I'm looking for it, or, you know. And it was the best thing ever because now I've got it on my retina.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I remember when, in 2003, when Mars was very close to Earth and very first time joined the Bucharest Astro Club, we went to this very dark place. And what we did, right, all night long in that place, we drew Mars.
Hmm.
And I could see Syrtis Major, which is what we were talking about before, how amazing that feature is on Mars. But I also remember drawing the Dumbbell Nebula.
Right.
So these two objects have been amazing things. And drawing, indeed, it just puts things out there in your brain. So you can find them, remember them. But it's everybody's eye, right? So, like, it's drawing these things through your own hand, right? It just makes it so beautiful.
It helps you to remember it.
So you just gifted us an amazing drawing of the Pleiades, which is, I'm looking at it right now on our shelf, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And it is an artistic representation. As I was saying, you're very talented. And you would think, you know, stars, but they're hard to draw.
Especially nebula as well.
Yeah. That is absolutely fantastic. We'll put a picture up online.
You
always say drawing, making a straight line is difficult. Making a dot is difficult. A round dot. That's not as easy as it sounds.
Because you've got to try and capture the magnitude and the color.
Right. Yeah. Right. And you have to have the positions correct.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you start with something in the middle, and then you put another one in, now have make a triangle, and you work with triangles, basically, and try to measure them off, and keep going.
Any tip for our listeners?
Any tips for drawing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that I would start there. You know, if you could go online to the Astronomical League, they have observing clubs. And I love their observing clubs because they have long lists of anything you would possibly ever want to observe. If you're into galaxies, they've got flat galaxies, they've got groups of galaxies, regular nebulas, just the best nebulas. And they have a nice list for you. But they also have a sketching club.
Wow.
And in the sketching club, you have to sketch, I believe it's 50 objects. And they have, here are the 50 you need to sketch. And it really is a nice way to get started and to learn how to do that. But, yeah, to get started, you draw a circle. That's your eyepiece view. And I think of it as actually the numbers on a clock, 12, 1, 2, 3, going all the way around. And you move your eyepiece so that you have a star in the center. Because that's really easy to find the center. And then you kind of work it out there. Take the next bright star, and from that point is out. The 2 o'clock is about a third of the way, two-thirds of the way. You put the next bright one in.
Yeah.
Once you have 2, you can calculate the third one. Once you have those, keep working triangles to get the bright ones in. Then you work some of the fainter. You don't have to put every object in. That's not that critical or important. And keep in mind, this is for you. So as long as you enjoy it, what you're creating is really wonderful, and it's something that you will remember.
Mm.
So just have fun with it. And there are lots of books that will teach about shading and doing all that kind of stuff, too. But I would start with a star field, a simple star field to begin with. And you can get a lot of fun and satisfaction out of that.
You pick a simple one like the Sagittarius star field.
Yeah. Omicron. There you go.
So there are very many things out there that we can do, not just look at the stars, but draw them or just take in their beauty, because the night sky is...
The important thing is you get out there and look and do it your way.
Hmm.
If you just like looking and you're scared to pick up a pencil today, that's fine. Just look through the eyepiece, but don't look in the eyepiece for 2 seconds and pull your head away and say, what's next? You have to soak it in. You have to really allow yourself to see what you're looking at and try to find some of that. It's going to take your eye a little time to adjust to see some of the fainter stuff.
Some of it's really subtle, and to see those subtle contrast differences. It's like when you do a solar observing and people just, like you say, they go and they look and I can't see anything. We go, well, take your time. And then when they do take their time, suddenly they start seeing some of the granulation on the surface. And if there's like an active region or whatever, they can spot it out.
There is a prominence there.
Yeah. But these things don't just leap out at you. They require you to take your time, think about it, look around the whole eyepiece, use averted vision, you know, and get used to the subtle changes in contrast.
It's like the thing in hiking where they say, well, if you walk your own walk. Well, in this you're going to explore astronomy any way that you want to do it, that's going to be fun for you.
You start your own stars.
Yeah. There you go.
Wow, and with this amazing advice in mind, Haritina Mogoshanu,
Sam Liski,
Pete Detterline,
we wish you clear skies so that you can always see the stars and always remember that we are made from the same stardust as they are.
And look out for the February full moon. It's going to be a bad one.
And keep looking up.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari. Star Safari.